listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. Ed McGrogan, Steve Tignor here to discuss quite a bit today. This is certainly an off-the-court podcast, I would contend, in terms of what we'll be discussing, but it has plenty to do with, you know, what we will see on the court based off of, I think, three pretty interesting topics here, Steve. And I want to lead with what really just broke about an hour ago, Tuesday morning, Maria Sharapova getting her two-year meldonium ban reduced to 15 months. I was on a call with CBS Radio earlier this morning, did like a 10-minute spot about it, and as often happens in radio and not in the podcasting world, they end up taking that and taking about 5 seconds worth of it to actually use on the air. And what did go on the air was my remark saying that this is, however you think of it, really the first day of the next stage of Sharapova's career. So maybe I'll leave it, leave that kind of hanging, and you know, what did you think of the whole outcome, and really what does Sharapova do next from here?
Well, I guess she has to be happy. She had it reduced. I think really we got to the right result in a pretty roundabout way, and not really a way that I think could serve as sort of precedent for any other case, and not really the way you want to go about it. 15 months is what she'll end up serving. It was originally 2 years, so I think she has to be satisfied with that at this point. I think she originally wanted it much less. It is a difficult case. She, you know, by the rule, she could have gotten 1 to 2 years for being negligent about taking a banned substance that she didn't know was banned, and not going far enough to find out that it was banned. A substance she had been taking, she says, for medicinal purposes, but the tennis authorities obviously thought she was taking it for performance enhancement. It's obviously a tough case in that way. She, you know, here's something she was taking for a long time. Legally, you can't really say whatever reason she was taking it, meldonium, in the past, it doesn't matter because it wasn't banned, and suddenly it was banned. So really all you can say is she was negligent, and where do you go from there? I think 15 months, that's about right. You know, you're legally, and by the letter of the law, she'd get 1 to 2 years. So 15 months seems right. And I think that's a significant punishment for what she did. The whole thing went through an appeal process, and I don't know if anybody would say that's the way it should have gone, but we ended up, I think, to me, in the right place.
Yeah, I mean, this is how a lot of cases of this subject really seem to play themselves out, really, in whenever CAS, the Court of Arbitration of Sport, is involved. And I wasn't terribly surprised that they did relieve Sharapova of some of the suspension. Typically, I feel like they often try to almost arbitrate meet somewhere that can appease both. This is kind of, you know, as it says in the name, this is really an arbiter of two parties, you know, wishes on this decision. And so in that regard, I'm not too surprised that it gets knocked down a bit. As you say, you know, we're really quite a ways into this 15-month ban now. Sharapova will come back scheduled to in April. This is before the French Open, before, you know, Wimbledon the rest of the year. I think, you know, to stay on the case for just a moment, that the key was, as you say, there was still fault in Sharapova and what she did. I think given the, I feel like, intensified microscope on tennis lately, given, you know, we just saw kind of an outside the lines report on ESPN's website about the sport and why it seems to be almost unnaturally clean in terms of doping. I think that tennis really is, you know, they have to uphold that precedent for their players. And quite frankly, for a star player, that makes a pretty big statement as well. Now, this was taken out of the ITF's hands by CAS here, but it's a decision that it seems like certainly the Sharapova, you know, can live with here, and she's going to end up coming back. Still, I think this is, you know, important that she's basically still coming back kind of in the prime of her career. This was the key, I think, to having this, is she lost really a portion of her playing days where, you know, clearly she was still one of the three, four best players in the world, and, you know, will come back to the tour at still sort of an uncertain time of where the WTA is, who is, you know, what is Serena's grip on all this. So, you know, it's going to be obviously very interesting to see how Sharapova performs when she comes back, but it's also, I think, a pretty telling result for really tennis as a whole.
Yeah, I think in there's positives from it that tennis was willing to suspend a top player, a star player, and that it will serve as an example for other players in how seriously they take, finding out what's banned and what's not banned, and that has to be, you know, that in itself is a good example. I think also it's helped spur some of the things over the last few years that have happened in tennis have helped a little spur a little more transparency from the sport. Now they're not going to, the sport is supposedly no longer going to allow people who test positive to keep that a secret while the trial process goes on, while the investigation goes on. That will become public.
The silent ban, yeah, so to speak.
Silent ban. So that hopefully, you know, I think transparency has been an issue with tennis. I also think, I don't know if Outside the Lines says that tennis is lax. I don't know if I agree with that specifically as compared to other sports. They do test pretty regularly. You know, you can always say you could do more. For the money they have, I think they focus on the top players. They do test out of competition. They do blood tests. I mean, there could be more, but I think that's more than some other sports do. I think the one thing you could say is that the ITF maybe shouldn't do the testing. They should take it away and have it be an independent organization that does that. I think that's the one thing that's been shown with tennis. It is insular, and I think that came up with the revelation after the Russian hack with therapeutic use exemptions that a lot of tennis players, Serena Williams, Venus Williams, Rafael Nadal, others have used banned substances as medicine, have gotten exemptions for that, which is perfectly fine. You can't deny athletes medicine because it's also performance enhancing. But at the same time, it's obvious you can go too far with that. You have to, you know, I think tennis has to watch that. Maybe that's more than anything the thing that needs to be watched and looked at, are those exemptions.
Yeah, that was something that probably may have caught quite a few people off guard, is even hearing about that to begin with. But it's true that those exemptions were in place for specific reasons and for specific cases, individuals there. Just, you know, one last thought on Sharapova. I kind of tied back to where she ends up coming back and all this. I mean, where do you see kind of the stage of her career, really? And, you know, she, over the years, especially coming into, you know, before all this happened, she had clearly made herself, actually a clay court threat more than anything else, but really developed her career from into an all court player, and, had seemingly maintained that status really on the top three, top five for quite a while now. And I think that was, you know, part of why, this this would be troubling to her at any point in her career, but it really did seem to take her out at a time where maybe Sharapova, you know, was perhaps nearing a good push to ascend to really the top of the game there. I mean, where do you see her when she returns here, considering the landscape?
Yeah, her career has been, you know, ups and downs. It's sort of a mini Agassi-esque career with injuries, and then to come back up, and then, you know, maybe some more injuries, or, you know, when she always sort of rises back up every couple of years, and maybe that was that sort of cycle was taken away from her. I think she didn't have the prime of her career taken from her in these 15 months, but it might be actually a more difficult point. She's in her late 20s. Now it's, you know, it's how do you come back from that after 10 years on tour, more 12 years on tour, you're in your late 20s. You know, now it's not really a case of having your best years robbed from you, but it's a case of how much time do you have left to really get back and do anything. So I think it may have been one, you know, that might have been the toughest time for a player like her to get something, to have something like that happen. But I do think, you know, I don't think anybody, you know, it's not like the game has moved on from her really, or there's been a lot of new blood that's come in that she won't be able to handle. Angelique Kerber's number one. Sharapova obviously can play with her. So we'll see. It's just a matter of how long does it take her to get back, you know, to her top level. Is that all the way until 2018? Then that's getting to be a while.
Yeah, I think it's a good, we'll have plenty of time to get into Sharapova's stature of the game once we near her April return date next year. I want to stay on the WTA for a moment after hearing CEO Steve Simon's comments earlier in the week about really the future of the tour in general. And I what I thought was almost kind of a message about tennis and perception on the sport. Mainly, you know, the main point was that the matches just simply are taking too long, and that, you know, in and of itself may not be an issue, but when you consider what it's doing to the players, and really what it's doing to attracting new fans to the game and retaining the interest in the game, because matches can stretch out for, you know, I've always thought this about tennis is, you know, a long match is quite often running longer than any length of a baseball game, a football game. It's rivaling those times, and it's hard to expect fans to maintain that interest, not just in one day, but day after day after day throughout the whole weeks and months of the calendar year. And I think Simon, whether this is just spitballing or not, talking about, you know, how can we get matches to just be more of a condensed nature? He mentioned actually ideally want to get matches down to 60 and 90 minutes, which in many cases seems like it's going to be hard to do given the format of tennis. And I bring this up with you especially because, you know, this has been a topic that's really been discussed in the sport, even at the lower junior levels for a while, that, you know, do we need to kind of speed up the game, so to speak, and how does that relate to the future of the sport?
Yeah, in the U.S., the USTA is making a big push to reduce the time that it takes to play tennis recreationally, first of all, to get people with busy schedules to play, to get kids who, I think it's the biggest thing for tennis here, is to try to get kids who have heavily regimented schedules to play, to be able to play tennis, to fit tennis in. And as it is now, they don't feel like they can, so they want to try to reduce that. They've changed scoring rules in college tennis to no ad. There's no warm-ups. They play single sets and doubles. So I think that's an overall push. I think with Steve Simon, I think the idea is, I think the question is, how much do you want to do to change tennis for television sake?
Right.
In the 70s, early 70s, tennis was willing to do anything to get on TV. That's what the WCT, when it first went pro, they used colored tennis balls. They changed from all white to colored clothes. They brought in the tiebreaker. They basically, the whole idea was, how do you, tennis will be nothing if it's not on television, was the idea. And that's still a question. Like, if, you know,
how much do you do to get on television? Is that the be all and end all? In the 70s, it was decided it was. And that made the sport more popular, helped make the sport more popular. It's a fact, you know, it's on TV. If it's not on TV, a sport, you know, from a mass perspective, doesn't really exist. And I think talking to people at ESPN, the way that tennis would slot in and get to be on prime time more would be if it was shorter, and if they could anticipate the length of their, of how much they needed to program. There, some, you know, in the U.S., ESPN has been willing to, and the BBC, they're willing to show the slams in their entirety, the length of the slams, but that's not something they can do more than four times a year. That's not something they're going to do in prime time or throughout the course of the year. I think Steve Simon's ideas, and I think people at ESPN have the same idea. How do we get tennis to be more, to be easier to show more often on a more consistent basis? And I think that's where these formats come in. And I think it's worth experimenting with. You know, nobody wants to see the Grand Slams go in that direction, play super tiebreakers. I don't think people even really like super tiebreakers. That was the one thing when I talked to some rec players about shorter formats. They didn't like that one. But I think things even like four game sets and no ad, I think it's worth experimenting with the tournament, see how people feel, see if it's a satisfying thing to watch. You'll see more different players. Matches won't be as long, and you won't have epic matches, but you'll see more different matches. I think it's worth starting to talk about and worth an experiment with and see what people think.
And now, one thing you could conceivably do is, and I've heard sort of whispers about this, is that, you know, you talk about you're not going to see a format like that in the Grand Slams, but there are so many other tennis tournaments that are played during the year that really are following the same formats. But, you know, who's to say you don't want to try a different playing format in a lower level tournament, for example? Now, we saw that years ago, that really did not work whatsoever with the round robin concept. But this, you know, that was a different way to determine a winner. These new formats, whether it's Fast Four, which was shown, really touted by the Australian Federation, U.S. Federation, you know, this is a way to speed up the game. You're kind of going to a different end. And, you know, maybe that's something that you not only consider trying that in, you know, a challenger level setting, but maybe even some of the lower rungs of the pro settings as well. See how that goes. And that ties into one other point that Simon made that I thought was worth paying attention to. Is really about the value of the WTA tournaments, the strata of them. You know, clearly, we know that the Grand Slams have the most currency for players. And for men's tennis fans, it's been known for since the early 90s, you can, I believe, you know, when the Super 9, the Masters Series, Masters 1000, it's gone through a couple different names. You know, when those were established, and those have clearly been identified by both fans and players, just as importantly, as, you know, the second tier but still very important events. And that's been a lot of confusion on the WTA side. There is not that clear delineation of what are the most significant events from a tour perspective. And I think, you know, more than anything else, I think this is something that the WTA should hopefully be able to accomplish, is to really just, you know, not, they've streamlined their calendar to make it a little bit shorter than the men's game. I appreciate that, but I do think there is a lot of confusion as to, unless you're really in the weeds of tennis like you and I are, you know, as to what are the sort of the touchstone events beyond the slams. And I think that's important really for the growth of the tour.
Yeah, I think the one thing the ATP has done in its entire history that you can say was a definitive success was to create the Masters Series. And, you know, the top players as of the mid 90s, turn of the century, just weren't playing each other enough. They were all scattered all around, and you didn't have tournaments that really meant anything other than the slams. Now you do. And that, I think that really helped develop this era that we're in to get all the top guys playing each other a lot. And obviously, you know, nobody's played as often as Djokovic and Nadal and Djokovic and Federer, et cetera. And that didn't happen before. I think that means mandatory tournaments, more mandatory tournaments everyone has to go to. Players sometimes complain about that, but I think it's essential. It's been essential. I think Simon is right that the WTA needs to have more of those. They only have four, one of them which is in Beijing, which is great for the WTA in a way, and that in expanding it, but it's not great for any viewers here or in Europe. The main sort of lion's share of people who would watch can't really see it. So I think more of those four, you know, you add a couple of those and you time them around the slams. That's the other thing that the ATP has done well, and you advertise them as the big tournaments. You know, you can see that the draws are good at these tournaments. It's, you know, you can't ask for anything more than this Beijing event as far as players. So I think that's a definite for the WTA to look at.
Yeah, it's a way to rebrand, I think, and we'll see what comes of that discussion, but certainly something that I think was worth looking at. You know, someone really willing and someone of his position internally willing to kind of speak up on that. Want to close with a player you just mentioned, Novak Djokovic. Speaking of playing a lot, he has done that for probably the past 5 years, clearly been the best player in the world over, for the majority of this stretch. For a while there was, last year and really the start of this year, you had even talks of, you know, Djokovic posting some of the best seasons of all time. Didn't turn out that way this year. Last year, he even managed to top his 2011 season. The point of all this is in saying that Djokovic really had kind of gobbled up everything there was to win, and every sort of loss that he had was seen as this catastrophic event, sort of like Federer in his peak years when he, you know, he used to say he created a monster given one of his Australian Open losses. I think it was to Djokovic in 2008. But Djokovic, you know, this has been his second half of the year has not been one for him to remember, even though there's been some nice results. He said he's now come out and said that the number one ranking in Grand Slam tournaments are not going to be the be-all end-all for him. They are not, you know, there is more to his career, there is more to his life than tennis. And, you know, there's certainly nothing wrong in saying that, obviously. It was just particularly interesting given a few things, that Djokovic is really still clearly, I think, on his best day, the best player in the world, the prime of his career. Djokovic also has, you know, somewhat recently, to say you don't want to track down number one and really the mileage that comes with that is one thing, but I thought him saying that even slams are not, you know, this willing to give everything for in the future was pretty interesting. You know, he's not that far away, obviously, from Nadal and even Federer in the Grand Slam title count, and it seems like we, in a way, subconsciously or not, are kind of moving, maybe as Djokovic just about to turn 30, you know, coming up, you know, are we kind of sort of segueing into the next phase of his career in a way? I mean, what did you take away from Djokovic's comments, which, you know, it seems like we're a long way away from him winning the French Open, even though it was just a few months ago.
Yeah. Yeah. As far as if he had said those words anytime before the last month or you know, right after the French Open, it would have been really stunning, because I think his mantra has always been anything is possible. I don't put any limits on myself. I can win, you know, calendar year Grand Slam. I can do anything. I'm not gonna, you know, everything is my goal, basically. And this was obviously very different. He's not going to set any particular goals as far as his results. But judging from his last couple of months, it didn't surprise me. I think he's had a little burnout or hangover from winning the French Open, and all that went into that over the years, winning four straight slams. I think he's had some personal problems he's alluded to. He's had a little bit of an injury. I think the Olympics were, from what has been said, was a tough loss for him in the first round. You know, I think he took it hard when he lost the bronze medal match to Del Potro in 2012. I think the last thing he wanted to happen was for that to happen again, another loss to Del Potro in the first round this time. So we'll see if it's a temporary. The only thing I would say is this a moment where he's just sort of thinking out loud about how he feels right now, or is this something, is he going to try to find a way as he gets towards 30 to motivate himself in a different way than he has? He's been pretty dialed in for about 5 years. And I think it's hard to stay motivated at the level he is. He really, by the end of the French Open, he didn't have any rivals left. He didn't have anybody challenging him. He'd won four straight, first guy since Laver to win four straight. Andy Murray was number two, and Djokovic has been beating him constantly for years. Nadal was way behind. He pretty much left everybody behind at that moment. So how do you continue to motivate yourself? And it'll be interesting to see. I think Djokovic is looking for a way to do that, to enjoy tennis and not just feel this, not just feel pressure to win. I think he's probably in the process of thinking about that. It sounds like he may reassess his relationship with Boris Becker. And to me, it'll be an interesting how an athlete, top athlete like that, handles sort of the next stage of his career. In that sense, I found it interesting. Not so surprising after the summer he's had.
Yeah, it's a good way to look at it there, and I think, as you say, Djokovic's his response to it, really, you know, when we end up seeing him again, quite frankly, I think, it doesn't seem like it will be until the Shanghai or Paris Masters or the World Tour Finals, but I think Djokovic's response to it will really sort of signify where really the tour kind of goes from here. He has been in the driver's seat, as you said, for such a long time now. And I think you make a great point about, you know, what was there left to do after the French at that moment. He had been targeting Roland Garros really since 2012, I want to say, when he first had the opportunity to complete a career slam. That was put so prominently in his mind as the tournament that he had to win, that would be dogging him throughout his career if he couldn't. And, it's hard to imagine you say, well, what am I going to do next? Win another Wimbledon? But that's, in a way, what Djokovic was sort of presented with, after completing that Djokovic slam, in a sense, as you said. So, I certainly hope that it is sort of a temporal thing, as you say, because, I do have a hard time sensing that Djokovic would really kind of just sort of let things just fall where they may, in a sense. He has proven himself to be, one of the most mentally strong players over this 5 year run of his, and it would certainly be a shame if we were in any way, kind of this chase, this sort of fictitious chase of Nadal and Federer and Djokovic and where their slam numbers are going to end up. It's going to be, when we look back on tennis decades from now at this era, I mean, this sort of race between those three and how it's all going to shake out, we don't know the answer, obviously, but I think we're going to remember this as one of clearly the greatest eras the game has ever seen. So to me, that's, I guess the uncertainty and the anticipation.
I think also Djokovic doesn't want to, he probably looks at
Federer's slam total. He's a few back, and he probably anticipates getting these questions about it for years. And he just probably right now, he just doesn't want to think about it. He doesn't want to have that, that sort of pressure for the, seemingly probably for 3 or 4 years, he probably does not look forward to that, and wanted to, I think maybe kind of get ahead of that in a way and say that he's not really you know, don't ask me about that every day. I'm not thinking in those terms right now, and I don't want to think about it in those terms because it's too much pressure to have that as my goal. That's the Federer number of 17 slams. So, well, I think when Djokovic gets maybe with a little break, and when he, I think it's hard for these guys, hard for anyone, to say you're going to be relaxed about competing until you, and then go out and compete. Once you get back, once he gets back into a slam, say in Australia or something, I think it'll, his, you know, he'll go back to a normal level of motivation, is would be my guess.
Yeah, and Australia has treated Novak Djokovic very well over the years, as we know. We will get to more results-based discussion next week, I think, but we want to touch on these topics. So for Steve Tigner and Ed McGrogan, we'll be back next week on the Tennis.com podcast. Thank you for listening.
You've been enjoying the Tennis.com podcast. For all the latest news and events, head over to Tennis.com.